20 years ago, I was roped in by just how nice everybody was. I came here in the winter of 93, in the early part of 1993, and to sign up for the Ed Brown cooking workshop that this place was doing as a fundraiser. And I came for meditation instruction and stayed for meditation on a Wednesday night. Kathy Toldy was the Dawan. Catherine sat here in those days. And the Dawan seat was over there rather than over here. So the bell ringer was over here. And she was kind of the Eno, taking care of things. She was the Dawan and the Eno role that Chuck has. And everybody was coming in for meditation. And I was sort of standing out by the shoe rack. And Kathy came out. I was the only one left out there. Kathy came out and said, you know, we're going to be starting. Were you planning on coming in for meditation? And I said, well, yes, but, you know, there's still 2 more minutes left. And I couldn't imagine why we're going to sit for 40 minutes, why people would go in early. And I think I had it in me or in my head. I said, you know, I maybe could squeeze out 40 minutes, but I definitely can't do 42 minutes. But anyway, she got me in here, and you know, it wasn't so bad, and I enjoyed Catherine's lecture quite a bit. Then we had tea in the house, and you know, people were socializing. Lynn and George were there, a couple about my age, and I hung out with them at tea for the first several weeks because they were very nice. Linda Sierra was there. She was also going to go to the Ed Brown workshop. And then, you know, Ed Brown is a real kick in the pants, a humorous guy, long-standing, you know, and revered Zen teacher. So it was... like I say, from the very beginning, this was a friendliness place. Lots of metta here. And that's what roped me in. And yes, we had instruction to sit up straight. And we did ceremonies. But it seemed like it was a good balance. There was real community here, and maybe the causes and conditions of my life, I was looking for community. Maybe I was looking for friends, but it just seemed to work. As I was thinking about this, so that was in February or so of 93. The first sesshin I did was right about this time. Was the summer of 93. About 20 of us trooped up for a weekend at Jikoji, just at the top of the summit. And you know, nobody knew anything about sesshin. Catherine herself taught Orioki instructions because there was nobody who knew it well enough to teach. A couple of people in the Monterey group, Sarah Hunsaker and Kathy Wilden, had done sesshins up at City Center in San Francisco. So they were kind of, they did everything for the first, you know, year or so. They were traded places as Tenzo and Eno and until, you know, there was a bigger group that knew how to fill the roles. But so this is like a 20-year sesshin anniversary for me. And it was beautiful up there at Jikoji. Hotter than it was yesterday here. I think today will be cooler. I think we've got more clouds today. But Zen came out of, as a branch of the Mahayana school of Buddhism, which developed around 100 BC, kind of hand in hand with Christianity. And, you know, both Mahayana Buddhism and Christianity had a little different focus than the earlier Theravadan Buddhism. They both tended to focus on compassion and universal salvation. You know, Buddha says that we can all be liberated from our suffering. A good place, by the way, to look at a nice overview of all of Buddhism is Tigan Layton's Bodhisattva Archetypes. It's now in a different printing and has a different title, but it's the same words. And it just sort of talks about everything, and is a good book for learning about Buddhism in general, historically and personally. The Mahayana school was also said to be influenced by lay people, not monks and nuns, but people living their lives in the world with family and work and school, that were studying Buddhism and becoming aware of their own Buddha nature. So the Mahayana school kind of threw the doors open for all people to practice liberation from suffering and helping other people to learn how to guide people in towards liberation of their suffering. That the Mahayana ideal, the Mahayana practitioner or even saint, was the Bodhisattva. And you don't have to be a saint. You just have to be. You just have to arouse this idea of bodhicitta. I think I want to save all beings. I think I'm in this world because I feel a profound connection with all beings. And that feeling has liberated me, and I want to help others experience that feeling and that liberation. So in Mahayana Buddhism, we have bodhisattvas, and you know, we are all bodhisattvas. We can all be bodhisattvas. Maybe the fact that you're doing sesshin means that you have aroused bodhicitta in your heart and you're already bodhisattvas. But as I was saying yesterday, this feeling that we're all connected makes us pretty infinite, pretty intimate with this idea of infinity. You know, it's not just a huge number that we can't fathom. It's not just trying to imagine all those grains of sand on the Ganges, but it's something that we know pretty well, that if, you know, we already feel intimate with an infinite number of beings. And So in the Mahayana world of Buddhism is vast and infinite and includes many world systems. Maybe they're like solar systems. Or maybe, you know, we discussed yesterday the forest deities that Buddha's monks met while on retreat. Maybe there's many world systems that are right around us, you know, not even on another planet, but right here. So Mahayana Buddhism has also thrown open a big door to include all these world systems, the entire cosmos. This Sesshin, I've set up camp in the Dokusan room, and there's that stained glass, big stained glass in there that you can't really see from the outside because there are screens there, but please feel free to come and take a peek of this stained glass piece done by a friend of Catherine's and given to Catherine many years ago. And we've had it hanging in there for many years. But it's a stained glass of our mudra, which of course is called the cosmic mudra. And supposedly it's from a picture of Suzuki Roshi's hands a photograph that somebody took. So Suzuki Roshi's mudra. But the artist has put the sun. Has put the sun and the moon and all the stars right in this palm, and it's beautifully done. The stars are like costume jewelry, you know, those big cut glass gems. So it's I hope all of you can see it. That's where we live. Amongst the sun, moon, and stars, connected with all beings in the cosmos. The Lotus Sutra appeared in the early Mahayana years. Mahayana sutras started appearing, you know, and this was 200 or 300 or 400 years after Buddha's death. But one thing that we can ponder is you know, actually Buddha's words in the Pali Canon weren't written down for 100 years after his death. So more of Buddha's teachings just started appearing 200 or 300 years later, passed down by our ancestors that we chanted this morning, both male and female. Those supposedly are our ancestors in this realm, not of any realm that we haven't named yet. So the Lotus Sutra started coming out in the early Mahayana period. It's 28 chapters long. Maybe it was given at a sesshin just like this. You know, it must have taken many days or many months to go over all 28 chapters. So maybe the Buddha was leading a retreat just like this, and in different retreatants. Maybe Mysterious Dragon remembered one day, and maybe Brian remembered another day, and they told it to their disciples, and it finally got written down a few hundred years later. And it's thought that by 200 Christian era, 200 AD, it was put together as the Lotus Sutra, 28 chapters. Finally, it was all put together. But you know, this sutra is revered in East Asia, China, Japan, Korea. Dogen mentions it extensively throughout his Shobogenzo, his 95 chapters of work. Just another sideline. Catherine kind of took it up the last couple of years of her life. She'd, of course, heard Suzuki Roshi's lectures on it, 40 years before, but she took it up in earnest, going to Taigen. Taigen wrote a nice book on the Lotus Sutra. There's a monk from a Chinese Buddhist tradition who's a scholar up at UC who taught a class in the Lotus Sutra to his students, and Catherine, in her mid-80s, what do you call that when you take a class, not for credit, audited it. Yeah, so Catherine shuttled on up there. I think she took the monk out to dinner a few times. That was her tuition. Catherine was in semi-retirement then, and so she mainly, taught her classes down in Monterey. She gave a workshop here in it, but she taught it, and she wasn't driving much then, so several of us have been lucky over the years to be called on to be her driver. Chuck did it for a while, and Charlie Dixon did it for a while. The Monterey people had their troops that drove her back and forth, and I was her driver going down for the Lotus Sutra. So that's how I was first introduced to the Lotus Sutra, going down to Monterey on Sunday mornings. The first part of the Lotus Sutra, the Buddha assures everyone there, and there for many world systems, the whole cosmos was there, but assures everyone that, someday you'll have your own Buddha field. Someday you'll be a Buddha, especially if you keep studying the Lotus Sutra. He was teaching the Lotus Sutra. Here in this realm we had the Theravadan practitioners, the Arhats. That was one vehicle. There were the Pratyeka Buddhas, the sort of hermit monks that had insights into the nature of all things from their own solitary meditation. That was another school of another vehicle. And there were even some bodhisattvas around, the Mahayana vehicle. And, he was promising Buddhahood to everyone there. And that was, he said, because there's just one vehicle. There's just one way to practice. But there were all these people from different lands and different planets there. And so it was this idea that wherever you came from, whatever practice, that there are many, many practices that flow into this, many streams that flow into this great ocean, this one great ocean, this one vehicle. You know, and of course that was obvious because, you know, all the deities from other realms were there. But then he was, he really, the arhats that were all men, were all studying to be liberated and entering nirvana all along. But there were many, many thousands of nuns there that he turned to, led by his own aunt, had become one of his followers and led many nuns into the practice. And he turned to them and said, "You'll be Buddhas." And this was a great, liberation, non-liberation, the female liberation that the Buddha was teaching. Another aside, despite probably by the time Suzuki Roshi came in 1959, many of those first nuns that Buddha was promising Buddhahood to, they probably had already had their Buddha field by then, but in Suzuki Roshi's Japan, the men and women still practice separately. And even in the first years that Suzuki was here in San Francisco, the women sat on this side of the room and the men sat on that side of the room. But when they got Tassajara, sort of in the mid-60s, a few years later, Suzuki had learned a few things about practice. Even though he had been a monk for 40 years at that point, maybe 50 years, 40 years, he continued to practice, and he practiced with a new group of bodhisattvas, and it was the open-heartedness of Suzuki and all of his new bodhisattvas that Tassajara became the monks and the of both the male and female monks started mixing it up a little, and that's what we've inherited. So Suzuki kind of kept that tradition going, that the Buddha started when he was teaching the Lotus Sutra. Like I say, he taught it before it was put together as a one volume. So this was his example of the one vehicle that includes many practices, many skillful practices. What skillful means is a part of this section. Whatever practice it takes to open our hearts and help us realize our connection with the universe and liberate us from the tyranny of the single self. Those are my terms, not Buddhist terms. I'll own that. Whatever skillful means it takes, we're all part of this one vehicle of liberation from suffering. He even promised a Buddha field to Devadatta. This was Buddha's cousin who tried to kill Buddha. And he was, even in Buddha's time, kind of a notorious villain. Maybe he was Catwoman. Maybe he was.
Was Batman?
Yeah. But you know, he was known as a villain, and he even promised. You know, maybe Devadatta was scurrying around the outskirts of the practice place where they were studying this Lotus Sutra, and you know, Buddha was assuring all groups that they would have their own Buddha field, and he saw this little scurry in the back, and said, "Ah, Devadatta, my cousin." And you can just imagine the group was horrified that Devadatta would even be there. And he said, "You will have your own Buddha field." And that was great assurance for those of us that came from our house, that got a babysitter for the kids, that got a cat sitter, you know, so that we could come to this seven eon retreat to study the 28 chapters. You know, the Buddha even saw the lay men and women in the crowd and said, "You'll have your own Buddha field," and you know, we didn't believe it, but then. You know, when Devadatta got his own Buddha field, or the promise of, you know, "Devadatta, you know, if you just keep studying, I know you've been following me around my whole lifetime. You know, if you just take the Lotus Sutra into your heart, you're going to have your own Buddha field one day." So that was great encouragement for us lay people, men and women, that couldn't believe it, that we were going to... that we too were Buddhas. The second part of the Lotus Sutra, you know, the Buddha sort of explains to everybody, you know, "Yes, I've been teaching here, you know, for these 50 years, going to forest retreats," and, you know, he was, all his human monks were there, but that's when he was really showing people that he was also teaching in all of these cosmic realms. And this, he didn't just live, you know, these 80 years, but he had, you know, this lifespan that was infinite. And he talked about some of the powers that he has possessed. And so that's taken up in the second part, and we do one of in the chapter where he talks about, you know, his lifespan is a famous one, and we chant the Buddha's lifespan chapter of the Lotus Sutra here in one of the evenings. We used to chant it in the morning, but. It took too long. It was practically the entire lifespan of the Buddha. We couldn't do it all in the morning. But so now we chanted in the evening. That wasn't the reason. Those are my words, not any words of the practice committee. And the third part talked about bodhisattvas, the practice of several bodhisattvas. What I like to do is a famous chapter is about Avalokiteshvara, this bodhisattva of compassion. Maybe you can start. You can pass these out, and I think there should be enough. You know, there's bodhisattvas like us from this realm, but because Buddha has taught in many realms, there's, you know, bodhisattvas that weren't actually, you know, walking day to day with the Buddha going into the forest, and some of the sutras are about these. These famous bodhisattvas that might be from other realms. Manjushri, who sits on the altar, that we Avalokiteshvara, Kuan Yin, Samantabhadra, Kshitigarbha sits out in our garden, that cement statue with holding the staff. These may have been bodhisattvas that came to teach from other realms. And Avalokiteshvara is uses skillful means to practice compassion. He is kind of a shapeshifter. If you need a monk to save you from suffering, he'll be in a monk's body. If you need a nun, he'll be in a bodhisattva will be in a nun's body. The bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara can even be in a Buddha body. Avalokiteshvara is thought to be a fully realized Buddha already with his Buddha field, but has chosen to come back and practice in the mud with us. And that's that image of the lotus, you know, rooted in the mud, you know, but flowering towards the cosmos. Let me read you about what Taigen says briefly. Avalokiteshvara, the bodhisattva of compassion, is probably the most popular bodhisattva and appears in more different forms than any other bodhisattva. He is called Chenrezig in Tibet, the goddess of mercy, Guanyin in China, and in Japan there's three names, Kanon, Kanzion, and Kanjizai. Sometimes he has 1,000 hands and eyes. Sometimes he is wrathful with a head of a horse. One meaning of his name is regarder of the world's cries, implying empathy and active listening as a primary practice of compassion. So these, you know, 1,000 arms with an eye in it, you know, can go out and help immediately, can see what's going on, can hear what's going on, and because there's 1,000 arms, is able to reach out. An emanation himself of the popular cosmic Buddha Amitabha, Avalokiteshvara's own female complement, Tara, is also very popular. Both Bodhidharma, founder of Zen in China, and His Holiness the Dalai Lama, the Tibetan spiritual leader, are considered incarnations of Avalokiteshvara. You know, we say that these, you know, how does Avalokiteshvara go out and help people? It's like adjusting your pillow in the middle of the night. There's this idea that maybe I won't go too much into, but this idea that it's not a crusader, you know, who jumps on the horse and goes out. I'm using the images of my childhood. It's not the Lone Ranger that makes a beeline. There's something about this non-perceptual connection that is realized, you know, in the way that, you know, half asleep, in the way that we might be in that first, relationship, the first of Dongshan's ranks. you know, in the night, in the second rank, where, you know, the light is just coming through the windows. We're making out a few things that non-perceptual, non-conceptual way that we are just always connected to all beings and to the whole cosmos. That's how Avalokiteshvara helps liberate others. I talked yesterday about metta, you know, is a quality, is a state of mind, is something intrinsic, friendliness. You're known as a friendly person, although you can develop friendliness, and then, you know, throughout the rest of time, you'll be known as a friendly person. But metta is a quality, and this is this compassion, especially the way Avalokiteshvara liberates us from suffering, is imperceptible. Let's take a look at how this the Lotus Sutra says that Avalokiteshvara liberates all being. This is chapter 25 of the Lotus Sutra, and it's chanted daily in East Asia. Taigen says that when he was practicing in the early days of Tassajara with a monk from Japan, Taigen asked him, what do you miss about practicing with us? And Taigen was thinking that, well, maybe he would like to hear more Japanese, or maybe he'd like, you know, more Japanese food. But this Japanese monk said that he misses chanting this chapter of the Lotus Sutra every day. So I know I've chanted this up at Green Gulch on a visit up there once, so it's still alive. So let's chant this. It'll be a nice chant. Verse of the Universal Gateway, chapter of the Lotus Sutra. Bodhisattva Akshayamati asked a question in verse. O world-honored one of wondrous form, I inquire again of that Buddha child, what are the causes of his name regarding the cries of the world? The honored one of wondrous form replied in verse to Akshayamati, listen to the deeds of Avalokiteshvara, who happily responds in every quarter with vast pledge as deep as oceans throughout kalpas beyond reason. She served many thousands of millions of Buddhas, bringing forth this great Purva. For you, I explain it briefly. Hearing the name or seeing the form of Avalokiteshvara with mindful remembrance is not in vain, for the woes of existence can thus be relieved, even if someone with harmful intent push you into a fiery pit by mindly invoking Avalokiteshvara's power. The pit of fire will turn into a pool if floating on a vast sea, menaced by dragons, fish, or demon. By mindfully invoking Avalokiteshvara's power, the billowing waves cannot drown you. If you mount some rose lofty peak, someone will throw you down. Mindfully invoking Avalokiteshvara's power, like the sun, you would stand firm in the sky. If pursued by wicked men down from Diamond Mountain, by mindfully invoking Avalokiteshvara's power, they could not harm a sinful hair. If surrounded by vicious bandits, each with a sword drawn to strike, by mindfully invoking Avalokiteshvara's power, At once their hearts will turn to compassion if pursued by rulers and execution by mindfully invoking Avalokiteshvara's power. Their weapons will thereby shatter to pieces if imprisoned by shackles or chains, hands and feet bound and restrained by mindfully invoking Avalokiteshvara's power, suddenly shall be released. If by curses or poisonous herbs someone wishes to hurt your body, by mindfully invoking Avalokiteshvara's power, the harmful intent will return to its source. If you meet evil creatures, poison dragons, or various demons, by mindfully invoking Avalokiteshvara's power, none will dare to harm you. If surrounded by raging beasts with sharp fangs and dreadful claws, by mindfully invoking Avalokiteshvara's power, they will quickly scatter in all directions. If venomous snakes or scorpions threaten with deadly breath of fire, by mindfully invoking Avalokiteshvara's power, at the sound of your voice, they will turn and depart. If clouds, thunder, and lightning strikes, hailstones fall, and rains in torrents, invoking Avalokiteshvara's power, infinitely they will dissipate. When living beings suffer hardships burdened by immeasurable woe, the power of Avalokiteshvara's wondrous wisdom can relieve the suffering of the world. Fully endowed with miraculous powers, widely practicing wisdom and skillful means, in every land, in all directions, in no realm does Avalokiteshvara not appear. In all the various evil destinies of hell, beings, hungry ghosts and animals, the suffering of birth, old age, sickness and death are gradually relieved by Avalokiteshvara. O you of the true gaze, of the pure gaze, of the gaze of broad and great wisdom, of the compassionate gaze and the gaze of goodwill, ever longed for, ever revered, unblemished, serene radiance, benevolent sun, dispelling all gloom, Avalokiteshvara can subdue the wind and fire of woes, clearly illuminating all. The precepts of compassion roar like thunder. The kind heart is wondrous as great clouds, pouring dharma rain of sweet dew, quenching all realms of loving passion. In disputes before judgments or fearful in the midst of power, by mindfully invoking Avalokiteshvara's power, all hostilities will be dispersed. The wondrous voice of Avalokiteshvara, Brahma voice, voice of the rolling tide, surpassing all realms within the world. Therefore, keep it in mind, in each thought, without ever a doubt, Avalokiteshvara, the pure sage, in pain, agony, or death's distress, can provide a sure support. With all virtues, eyes of compassion, behold all beings, assembling a boundless ocean of happiness. Thus, you reverence, you should make prostrations. Then Bodhisattva Dharanimdaro arose from his seat, went before the Buddha and said, O world, only one, if there are living beings who hear this chapter of Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva, the benefits will not be slight for those people who come to know his deeds, his manifestation of a universal great way, and his supernatural powers. When the Buddha had preached his universal gateway, the 84,000 beings in the assembly all arose the thought of unsurpassed, complete, perfect enlightenment. Eyes of compassion behold all things. So that's a pretty nice line that we could maybe see better if we kept close to this heart, this idea that we're connected with all beings and the entire cosmos, that we're one flesh. I mean, like Stan was saying, it'll save us from getting glasses. It just makes, you know, seeing better. Eyes of compassion behold all beings. It makes us more intimate when our senses are open to the whole universe. So, are these all tall tales? Are there even other cosmoses? Is there some external force that's going to unlock our handcuffs? Make my back feel better? That's going to come, you know, just by, you know, having a visage, just by saying Guan Yin's name. What do we think? You know, we don't chant this, but, you know, we chant, we when someone we know is not doing well, is ill, we put a card on the altar, and those of us here in the morning, we chant the well-being chant, which is, starts off, Kanzeon, you know, we're invoking Avalokiteshvara to help them. We do that, you know, we're 21st century Americans, for God's sake, and we're invoking someone from another cosmos to help our friend in surgery. What do we make? Do we really believe that? I'd be interested to know. You know, this is maybe why some people, don't come back to Zen Center, you know, after they're, you know, made to chant, you know, long chants like this and do prostrations. This is a devotional practice. And maybe that's not, you know, the Buddha uses many practices to save us. And maybe that's, you know, a lot of us in the 21st century here in the West, we're just not into devotional practices. I grew up in a Lutheran church, and, you know, we don't have saints. We didn't do any bowing or anything. So it's not part of what I grew up with. But we're doing this, you know, devotional practice. Every time we're wishing our loved ones goodwill by, you know, invoking Avalokiteshvara in the morning. What do we think of that? Chuck.
Maybe all we can know is our intention. And, you know, maybe we can't have a pure knowledge of our beliefs, even. But maybe it's our intention. Maybe that's the best we can do. And I can't help but think about what you said in the beginning about part of what drew you here was the friendliness, the acceptance, the open-hearted attitude that is kind of all-embracing. And so the stranger comes in and we're all nice to them. That's part of the practice. And so I think that sometimes we rest in our intention, you know, and sometimes that has to be as good as it gets. Mm-hmm. But you can't be so sure, and that's okay.
Mm-hmm. Nice. Thank you. Thank you. If friendliness makes us feel good, makes most people feel good, it's not such a leap to say that same kind of thread can be followed out, you know, to the entire cosmos, and then all of a sudden we find that we've got a religion. You know, then you know, it goes from, you know, sharing tea in the house to, gee, I'm a Buddhist now. I'm religious. And I don't even mean to keep it in the Buddhist realm. It's, you know, if my father's family grew up in the Salvation Army because of they served good donuts there, many of that side of the family has become Salvation Army ministers, and you know, all of a sudden it was, you know, they were religious. All of a sudden, they were their bigger self, their spiritual self, their noumenal self. All of a sudden, they were they had dropped body and mind, and were part of the cosmos. I think they would say that. My aunt in her uniform would sit right up here and say that. Stan.
It sounds like they, like you, and I too, were given to by your parents. They were given to by the Salvation Army. And when you give, you want to give back. It's a natural response. I had an incredible experience in a field of grass, somewhere in the Central Valley. I'm not quite sure where it was. When I really stopped and thought, saw this grass waving in the wind, and thought how many kernels of seeds on each and every grass stem, which goes, of course, to the wheat, to everything else. It only takes... Why is it producing all this extra food? To feed all the other grasses and us, and... It's, and then one seed makes, or more seeds make more grass. But life gives the life to create life. And we're all like that. And that, every time I see plants or strawberries, look at all the seeds on the top of the strawberry, the same thing. Each almond that we had this morning could have been a tree, but now we're the tree. It's all this constantly giving from nature and through us back to nature and to each other and to all creation. We're all in it together. Mm-hmm. And we can choose to just live our separate lives and be our one seed for our one seed and our family or whatever. Or we can choose to give our seeds and ourselves to take good care of ourselves, but then also each other and all creation. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that's what we're here for. And that's the ideal. And yes, I believe in that because I see it myself, and I think we all see it when we open our eyes. That's who we really are.
No, that's very nice, seeing the heart of Avalokiteshvara in that field of grass. Very nice.
We are each and every one. Mm.
Yes.
A budding, what I like to say is a budding bodhisattva.
Thank you. Thank you. May we continue in this sesshin, settled deeply in our own Guanyin heart, open to the Guanyin hearts around us. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable.